Agenda is approval of the January 14th, 2015 minutes. Linda moves, Vita seconds. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposing? Abstaining? Motion carries. I don't have any cards for public comment not on the agenda, so we will move forward to subcommittee reports. Naomi.
Oh, okay, good afternoon. So the subcommittee, the Equity and Access Subcommittee, met earlier today at noon, and we talked about the California Household Travel Survey and the Bay Area Transit Passenger Survey. This was an information item that we had brought up earlier because we were concerned about a lack of very recent data about travel among our populations that we were interested in. So we were expecting a Bay Area travel survey to happen in 2010, and it did not. And so today we found out why, and it was because they combined that effort with the California Household Travel Survey with Caltrans, did a really big survey. So that was good. They collected a lot of data. Unfortunately, that data isn't really available for viewing yet, but they're working on it, and we requested an update on when that would be available for some more information. And we also learned about the Bay Area Transit Passenger Survey, and we're very interested to hear about how the MTC would like to work with the transit operators and, in essence, make it easier for the transit operators by paying for part of the survey and conducting it, and also coming up with a very consistent survey, which currently, if you compare the different transit operator surveys, they're not actually always consistent with each other. So we thought that was a very good idea, and we support that. It sounds like BART's starting very soon. And so that was sort of the overview on that. Before I see if anybody else from the subcommittee has anything to add, I just also want to note that we are ready to do our elections in our subcommittee. We're probably going to do that at our next meeting, which may be next month or maybe not. We'll find out. As always, we urge people to come to these subcommittees if they're interested, and for members of the subcommittee who might be interested in serving as an officer, please self-nominate. Our current officers, I don't think, are going to want to be officers anymore. So there's some openings there. I think that's it. Is there anything anybody else from the subcommittee would like to add about what we heard today? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Naomi. Item number 5 on the agenda, cap and trade update with Matt Maloney and Alex Bachelman. And I would ask people to hold questions until they're done with their Alex, are you doing part of this too? Oh, okay. Well, without a mic, she's not doing. But we'll let Matt start, and just hold your questions until after the presentation, please.
No, I'll be walking you guys through cap and trade this morning, and I'm sure Alex will be also happy to help me answering any of the thornier questions with the program. We've all been monitoring cap and trade very closely at MTC. Agenda 5 is a memo that I put together for you. It discusses three of the main cap and trade programs that we've been monitoring here at MTC. There's also three attachments to the memo, and I'll just kind of briefly summarize what those are. The first is a list of key dates, upcoming dates for the three programs. There's a lot of moving parts and sometimes kind of hard to understand where we are in the process. So I just put that together for you to kind of enable you to see where we are with all the programs. The second attachment, B, is a program summary of affordable housing and sustainable communities. This is directly from the AHSC guidelines, which gives a summary of what is a pretty complex program, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then attachment C, which are regional principles for prioritizing final applications under the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program. These principles were actually approved this morning at Programming and Allocations, and I'll spend some time talking about that. So I actually also want to mention that my memo discusses all three programs. I'm going to focus most of my energy talking about the first one, which is affordable housing and sustainable communities, because it's really the program that there's a lot of energy behind this program right now. There's a lot happening on it very fast. The other two programs are also very important, but I'll start with AHSC, and we'll see if the group wants to discuss cap and trade as a whole, as well as the other programs. We can also turn our attention to all of that. So affordable housing and sustainable communities, what the program does is it provides grants and loans to affordable housing, infill and compact transit-oriented development and infrastructure connecting these projects to transit. The program has $130 million statewide in the first year, and it receives 20% of cap-and-trade proceeds in the future years. The guidelines for the program were recently approved by the Strategic Growth Council, and a notice for funding availability has also been released, so that's on the street now. The program is administered by state agencies, the Strategic Growth Council and the Department of Housing and Community Development. So while these agencies will retain all project selection authority over the program, MPOs around the state, like MTC, have been offered an advisory role in determining proposal support of regional plans. So essentially, we can recommend a set of proposals to the state, but the recommendation is not necessarily binding. According to the Strategic Growth Council guidelines, project applicants must submit two rounds of proposals to be eligible. The first round are concept proposals. These are due February 19th to the department. These proposals require some amount of detail. They must generally describe the project, the funding amounts, and demonstrate a few other elements related to project readiness, description of GHG reduction strategies, etc. MPOs have been invited to review these concept applications in terms of their support for the implementation of sustainable community strategies. The plan really is for MTC and ABAG staff to jointly review these proposals, and we've included some of the simple screening criteria that we're going to use, and really where I am in the memo is on the top of page 2. In general, the concept proposals should increase the affordability and diversity of housing, help further a network of complete communities connected by high-frequency transit, and target investments in priority development areas in keeping with the One Bay Area grant program, which was a major recommendation of Plan Bay Area. So during this is a very quick time frame for the first round. So again, we're operating under the state guidelines. And so staff would be working on this effort between February 19th and early March. So that's the concept application part of this program. There's also a second step. So the Strategic Growth Council will be inviting project sponsors to submit final applications, which are due April 15th. So between April 15th and early May, MTC and ABAG staff would also prioritize applications using the set of principles proposed in Attachment C. So I guess we can turn our attention a bit to that attachment, and I can summarize what's in there, because that's really the meat of the regional principles that we adopted at Programming and Allocations this morning. So again, I want to reiterate that the role for us is advisory. We do not have project selection authority. We can just generally recommend to the state that the proposals that we get in support the Plan Bay Area. So in the final application process, MTC proposes first to cap the total regional priorities at 150 to 200% of the regional population share of the state. So this would be equivalent to submitting about $35 to $45 million worth of proposals for the first year. And the rationale behind this approach is simply that we believe that if we can tee up a focused, prioritized group of projects for SGC to consider, that the region will do well in this competition, to really show that it's setting priorities and looking carefully at the proposals. So there's six criteria that we've outlined that we feel like the region should use in terms of judging these proposals as they come in, and these are listed roughly in rank order of importance. Now, I want to mention that there's a lot of scoring criteria already in the state guidelines. We aren't necessarily want to put people through a parallel scoring process, but in general, we want to look at these proposals in terms of how well they achieve these criteria. The first criteria that we want to look at is significant greenhouse gas reduction. And while the Air Resources Board at the state level is utilizing available tools to help provide a uniform statewide methodology about GHG, MTC does have concerns that the tools that they're using may not fully account for the diversity and complexity of the Bay Area's land use, job center, locations, and transportation network. So given these concerns, MTC intends to analyze final project applications using a regional methodology that more accurately reflects the GHG impact of PDA-centered developments in the Bay Area. Secondly, we're prioritizing benefits to disadvantaged communities and communities of concern. So I want to say a little bit about this. So prioritizing projects located in or providing benefits to the region's communities of concern, as well as CALEPA's defined disadvantaged communities. So I think if you remember, and I think we've had this conversation before at this committee, currently 50% of this program must be spent to benefit disadvantaged communities, and that's according to a state definition of what disadvantaged communities are. And there's been a lot of talk in this region and a lot of disagreement about sort of what that definition should be, and MTC has been on record with its partners to the state looking to really refine that methodology. So while we acknowledge that the state has come up with their definition of disadvantaged communities, we also feel that it's important to include the region's adopted definition of communities of concern, as final projects will likely cast a wider net than what the state defines as disadvantaged communities. So essentially, we want to look at our definition of communities of concern as well as the state's definition of disadvantaged communities. Third, we want to support Plan Bay Area's focused growth investment strategies. This is prioritizing ready-to-go, transit-oriented development projects within priority development areas and high-growth jurisdictions and corridors that provide access to jobs and services. Staff will also consider high-performing integrated connectivity projects which require qualifying transit or one route departing two or more times during peak hours. And some of these terms, TOD, ICP, are really kind of baked into some of the state definitions that are part of SGC. What I've attempted to do to try to clarify some of these things like TOD and ICP, some of this stuff is in Attachment B, which is also included in your memo. So this really goes through those definitions at the state level to kind of clarify what the projects are that they're looking for. So fourth, in terms of the regional principles, is support for the region's adopted transit priorities. So as proposals come in, we'd like to prioritize those that support the Commission's adopted transit priorities, including the Regional Transit Expansion Program of Projects, which is Resolution 3434, Plan Bay Area's Next Generation Transit Program, projects under the Core Capacity Challenge Grant Program, and projects that support implementation of the Transit Sustainability Project. Fifth is funding leverage. We think it's important to prioritize projects that are leveraging other funding sources for local match. And sixth is the One Bay Area Grants Policy, or OBAG. So when it's applicable, OBAG's policy requirements should be applied to help determine a project's alignment with the Sustainable Community Strategy. These requirements include adherence with state and regional complete streets policies and general plan housing element adoption and certification. So that's just a summary of the regional principles that we here at MTC are looking to apply to proposals as they come in. Again, the proposals are due to the state February 19th. At that point, we expect the state will forward the proposals on to MTC for our review. In early March, it's a quick time frame, we'll be submitting recommendations on the concept proposals back to the state. Okay. After that, in April, the state will invite proposals to come back for final applications. So this is now a lengthier application with even more detail than the concept. So at that point in the April, late April, early May timeframe, MTC and ABAG staff would jointly look at those proposals, and that's really where these principles that are included in Attachment C come in. They come in at the final application stage. And at that point, we would be recommending proposals to SGC. And really by the end of June, the state fiscal year, we anticipate that there will be a program for the first year of the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities program. So I'm going to stop there. There's more in the memo about two other programs, but I know that that's a lot to take in. It's a very complex program. You know, it's not if MTC had devised this, we probably would have done it a little bit differently. That being said, we have been invited to play a role with this by the state, and we feel kind of ready and willing to jump into that in order to ensure that the Bay Area priority projects are getting their fair shake in the process.
Okay, at this point, we'll start taking questions. Naomi, and then...
Alex wants to add something.
I just wanted to have one point of clarification just to make sure it's clear before you have your discussion. The attachment that Matt went through, attachment C, I believe it was, that was considered today by the Programming Allocations Committee, but for referral to the commission. So it would be acted on by the commission. So if this body does have some comments, we could still provide that to them before they take action at the commission meeting.
Thanks.
Thank you. That's good to know. Naomi, then Sandy, and
Thank
then Jerry.
Under attachment C on number 4, it says support for the region's adopted transit priorities, and it does not list the coordinated public transit human services transportation plan. Is that also part of the adopted transit priorities?
Do you want to answer that here?
Definitely, that is one of MTC's adopted policies, and I'm just trying to think through sort of, I guess, I think we were thinking a lot about some of the more major transit investments, but I think your point would be that perhaps that coordinated plan would have some investments that would be key, especially in the category that the state is calling the ICP program. So I think we could certainly look at adding that as appropriate.
Thank you. It does have a number of recommendations related to transit.
Thank you. Sandy, then Jerry, then Linda, then Harriet.
Hi, Matt. I must confess I had stopped following closely what ended up being adopted as the final guidelines for the this program. I had attended the workshops that they had earlier in the year. And one of the concerns that I had raised at the workshop, and like I said, since I haven't followed, I don't know if anything was done about this, because I'm assuming I'm not the only person that brought this up. My concern was about, given the definition of the communities of concern, that this could segregate affordable housing in communities that were already low income and not provide opportunities for affordable housing and folks that are low income, that live in low income communities now, being able to move into communities that have more resources as far as educational opportunities and often the communities where they work, where their jobs are. Was that at all reflected in the guidelines where the housing needs to be put?
Well, I think that the answer is probably mixed to that question. I mean, I think one of the things that we should mention about this is that I was at a lot of those workshops too, and I think one of the concerns that I heard was really the disadvantaged communities criteria and the fact that there was such an emphasis on placing affordable housing in those communities. And so since that time, I mean, there has been some broadening of the disadvantaged communities criteria that the Air Resources Board and Cal EPA developed, a little bit, not necessarily to our liking, but a little bit. I think the other thing to mention is that in terms of the disadvantaged communities criteria, 50% of these investments should be to benefit those community. But that, again, half of the program need not be so geographically restricted to the communities that the state has come up with. I guess that is to say that we can cast a bit of a wider net in terms of where the project areas for these potential proposals could actually be. I think, like you, we want to make sure that they're not too restrictive and that there's some flexibility in terms of where we actually place these projects in places that they make sense. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, I just had it, like I said, since the workshop, which was many months ago, I had it followed exactly.
I should also mention, and this is probably late in the game, but there is a workshop here tomorrow that the SGC is holding in this room. I don't know how many of you were able to attend that. We were actually having some trouble here on a staff level even getting in. It seems like it's quite oversubscribed. There is a PowerPoint presentation, and you can also look at some of the other workshops that were held around the state, which kind of go through the process in terms of what they're looking for the concept application. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, and I also did want to share that So I work with a collaborative of 11 health departments here in the Bay Area, and our collaboration, along with a collaboration of health departments in the Southern California region, developed a different methodology of looking at disadvantaged communities, really from a health disadvantage lens. And I'd be happy to share that with staff. We have shared it with Cali PA. It hasn't gone anywhere. Okay. But I'd be happy to share it with you all and see if it might help inform your decision-making as well.
That would be great. Thanks.
Thank you. Jerry, then Linda.
Yeah, I guess you, at the end, kind of responded to what my question was. I was concerned about how grant information was being disseminated to potential grantees, and don't know if I missed it somewhere along the line, but there is going to be a workshop tomorrow, and how is the information going out to potential grantees so that they would know about the workshop and know how to respond to it?
So the state is administering these workshops. So the Strategic Growth Council is the agency that's administering the workshops. They're also responsible for disseminating the information in terms of their notice of funding availability, which lets potential proposers sort of understand what's required of them in terms of submitting the proposals. I know that information is being disseminated, obviously, via the internet. They have a dedicated website for this. In terms of what the state is actually doing to reach out and make sure that they're being inclusive about this process, I actually don't know. That'd be a good question for SGC, and that's something we could follow up with you on, unless Alex has more information.
Yeah, I was wondering whether MTC is possibly playing any role in at least getting out to those potential grantees that are under the Bay Area, nine Bay Area counties.
Well, I was just going to add to that. We did forward on the information that the SGC sent out to our various lists, in terms of the cities and the counties and the CMAs and the transit operators. We don't typically have a list of sort of all the housing developers.
We
sent it out to everyone that we normally interact with. The other thing for tomorrow's workshop, we were concerned because we started hearing from several potential applicants that they couldn't get into the workshop. So we did work with the Strategic Growth Council. We are going to be able to, I think, audio cast the meeting tomorrow, so at least that's something, because they kind of ran out of room because they're just in this room. Okay. So we're trying to do what we can to make sure that potential applicants can get the information they need. But again, it's not our program to administer,
we're
just trying to supplement what the state is doing.
I was primarily concerned about whether MTC was at least reaching out to those agencies where they have interaction. And the answer is yes. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Linda, then Harriet, then Mike.
Oh, thank you. On the communities of concern, is available job source one of the criteria? Because if there are a lot of jobs, that'd be a good way to bring people in.
The way that the communities of concern was developed, it was a several factor analysis, and I don't know that jobs was part of what was looked at. It more had to do with low income, minority populations, access to jobs. I don't have the whole list in front of me. I think it's been brought to you in the past, but I don't think that jobs in particular. I mean, obviously, it comes into several of those factors, but it's not, I don't think it was specifically one of the factors. And the communities of concern actually was developed through a pretty long process and has been adopted by the commission. So at this point, we weren't looking to update the communities of concern. We were just using something that we had in place from prior planning efforts and from the last RTP.
Just thinking in terms of if there are a lot of jobs, but there aren't people that live there to do it, then we're going to have more traffic on the road. So, okay, and the other question I had, too, was on the funding sources, that use a priority to funding sources, like, for instance, Measure BB passing, that give the projects that are in there priority?
Do you mean the funding leverage? question?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but potentially, I think this kind of gets to the idea that, you know, having projects that are really ready to go and to move quickly should be a priority for this region. And really, to kind of help move that along, we think that it's important to the degree possible that projects can show that they're leveraging other sources of funding, whether it's other local funds, other state funds, local or countywide tax measures. So all those things can come into play. We just think that's important for project readiness and to get projects moving.
Okay, thank you. Did you raise your hand?
Yeah. Thank you. Harriet, then Mike, then Joanne.
I'm curious, what method is going to be used to assure that the housing constructed will remain affordable over a period of time?
Well, in terms of the SGC criteria, I would say that there are, in their scoring criteria in the guidelines, there are a lot of different measures of criteria for affordability and different thresholds that they're using in order to score projects. Again, we are not subjecting proposals to exactly the same criteria, since the SGC will already be putting them through that. I'm kind of taking a look at the guidelines right now as I'm speaking to try to answer your question. There's certainly and this is something I can get back to you on. Probably it's probably the best thing for me to do is to get back to you or the group offline about your question about assuring that housing will remain affordable over time in perpetuity.
Okay, I can
assure you that there are plenty of criteria baked into the SGC to assure that affordability and really deep affordability is included in the guidelines. But it's a good question about kind of looking at the long view of it. So I can get back to you.
Okay.
Thank you. Mike, then Joanne.
Okay, I have two questions. First is on figure one. It says at the bottom, page 6 of 82, it's the first column, transit requirements, project area types, TODs, and we're specifically here talking about SMART in Marin. Marin County is avoiding TODs like the plague, but nevertheless they are building SMART. And it says one of the requirements, of course, is headway frequency of 15 minutes or less during peak hours.
That's right.
I believe as it is now, SMART's frequency is at least 20, if not a half an hour, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that they're out of the money, so to speak?
No, it doesn't. What that means is that potentially, depending on SMART's headways, they might not be eligible for the TOD piece of this, but there is also the integrated connectivity project part of this, or the ICP, which requires transit of really two or more routes departing an hour. So you have to have that, but you can't have that higher threshold of four or more times an hour. So it's kind of like something in between. So SMART and also, you know, other capital improvements or other programs that have that are closely related to SMART, my read of it is that they could be eligible under as an ICP under this program.
Okay, the reason why I asked that is because the sales tax they thought they would get when they initially started the construction did not come through. It's coming through now, but the project has been truncated from Larkspur to Santa Rosa, not to Cloverdale, and I know they want to get to Cloverdale. Okay, second question is, if I don't get an answer on this, this is okay, I understand. Track cap and trade started January 1st. Do we have any idea if we've had any money come in? Well, I'm sure there's money has come in, at least in the first month. And if so, and here's the tricky question, on January 1st up until maybe a week and a half ago, gasoline prices had continued to fall, and it looked like there was no negligible change in the sense that the companies that are involved in cap and trade did not show an increase, let's say, in the gas pump. Now that we've seen 35 cent increase in the last 2 weeks, do we have any idea that that is from cap and trade? Kind of a complicated question. You understand where I'm coming from here?
Let me first take on the first part of that, which I think has to do with really like what are the cap. I think what you're getting is what are the cap and trade revenues. What's the prognosis for these coming in the long term? And the you know the auctions for cap and trade have really not begun in earnest yet. They are going to be. I think there is one set of auctions this February. I believe there's a second set of auctions in, I think, May or June. The governor in his budget did put out some preliminary sort of forecasted figures about how much revenue would be flowing into cap and trade. That's really just kind of a guesstimate at this point. What I have noticed is that for some programs that are doing multiple years of funding, and this other program, Transit and Intercity Rail, one thing that they're saying in their guidelines is that they would be putting out that second year of funding, clarifying how much revenue it was going to be at the end of the fiscal year. So my best guess is by toward the end of June, we're going to have a better sense of how much revenue we're actually talking about for this program. And certainly one factor into that may be the price of gasoline, or it may not be. It's hard for me to guess in terms of what kind of impact that's going to have or where we're going to be in terms of gas prices at the close of the fiscal year.
Yeah, if you could come back in June, if you have those figures, that'd be great to hear if you
yep.
have them. Okay, thank
Will
you.
Will do.
Appreciate the answers, Matt.
Thank you. Joanne, then Kathleen.
Affordability. Is the prioritization related to how low, very low income going to get a higher priority in terms of applications, and is that established in the guidelines?
Yes.
Or special populations, which is seniors and disabled.
Right. So what I am, one of the things that I'm noticing here is looking at the SGC criteria on, I'm sure you don't have the guidelines in front of you. It's on page 39 of the Strategic Growth Council guidelines. But there are different thresholds for households with incomes less than or equal to 50% of area median income. Incomes less than or equal to 40% of state median incomes. There's different scoring thresholds depending upon the affordability of units. And
so it's not just affordability, it's the other sustainability criteria along with it.
There's also other sustainability criteria along with it. Yeah, it's a very complex program that looks not only at affordability, but also I think the wider net of what we would consider to be sustainability, livability strategies. In terms of how we're developing our communities. That's really the whole thrust of the program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Kathleen?
Looking at the kind of statewide goal to devote at least 50% of the funding towards affordable housing, will ABAG and MTC staff kind of be trying to apply some balancing in the recommendations to kind of hit a 50% target, or will you leave that primarily up to the state? For example, if you got something that took up 85% of that $35 million for transit,
right?
Would you weed out some transit projects?
I think that we would be following the principles that we've put down. I think the figures for this program are statewide in nature. It's obviously it's a huge state. We're one major part of that. I think when you read through our principles, obviously, I think we're very interested in transit-oriented development projects that are really ready to go. We want to get the money moving. We want to show that the region's serious about getting this money in the door, spending it quickly. We feel like we've got some catalytic projects that we can move on. We don't think we necessarily have to wait. No, we don't. Again, we're not really applying thresholds in our criteria on a percentage basis in terms of how much housing or how much transit. And in some ways, this is the first time we've been through this process, and I think in some ways we have to, just kind of sit down and see what we get in and really see what the proposals look like in order to make that kind of determination. But we're not really going to be, striating proposals based on that necessarily.
And then in the guidelines that SGC adopted, are they transparent about any weight that they'll give and a walk across between regional definitions of community of concern and their advantage, like disadvantaged communities?
Well, they are not. The one thing that they have just included in their guidelines is that they're offering MPOs an opportunity to advise them on project selection, and that advisement needs to be related to how projects support sustainable communities strategies. And, you know, this is part of the state laws, is that really these programs should follow sustainable community strategies. One thing that we found when we've read the guidelines is they're not so clear about how that's going to be operationalized. So I think that one of the ways that the state feels like they can get around this is to include us, I guess, a bit in the process, so that we can help guide the process using our own local experience. So
that helps. Thank you.
Okay.
Sandy?
Hi, as we went through this conversation, I realized I needed some clarity. So for this program, the Affordable Housing and a Sustainable Communities Program, it's not just for affordable housing. It's for housing and affordable housing and TOD. And I had been assuming it was all affordable, and then it should also be TOD, and it should also be connecting, you know, those projects to transit. But is it not all affordable?
Not necessarily. So I think one of the best, what I tried to do in Attachment B was to clarify, really this is kind of the best page for sort of understanding what is eligible under this program. And it's very complex, but and so one of the things that you'll see is this difference between what they call transit-oriented development and integrated connectivity projects. Those are the two, the way they're classifying these. You have to be one or the other. And, you know, the first threshold really to look at in this program is your transit headway. It's really how much transit do you have. If you have a lot of transit departing during peak hours, then you're a TOD. And if you're a TOD, then you need to have a housing part. It needs to be an affordable housing part, or it needs to be another housing capital infrastructure investment that's related to affordable housing. So that's a requirement for TOD. The other side, which is the integrated connectivity project, is a little bit different. It doesn't have this high qualifying transit criteria as part of it. You need to have some transit, but not high quality transit. So that's kind of the difference in the definition. And I would say that part of the program is slightly more flexible in terms of the capital investments. It does not necessarily require a housing capital investment to it. So there could be an ICP project that might be related to transit, to bike ped infrastructure, things along those lines. So it's the TOD part that's a bit stricter about that. And just to give you also like a flavor of how this program's going to roll out, the SGC has said that 40% of the program will go, at least 40% of the program will go to TODs, and at least 30% of the program will go to ICPs. So they're going to, that's just the floor of what they're going to fund these things at. So we'll have to see the way that the program takes shape, but that's what's in the guidelines right now.
But I think just to answer your question, that if it's housing, it is affordable housing.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to be clear. And I'm like, are we saying that the housing does not have to be affordable? But it does. For this program, if any
right.
housing that's proposed needs to be affordable housing.
It has to be affordable, and it has to be within, right, there has to be an affordable housing development for TODs in the TOD section that's within the project area. You don't necessarily need to spend the SGC money on the affordable housing project, but you need to have that project there entitled, ready to go. So hopefully that answers your question. Thanks, Alex.
All right.
Thank you. And I'm trying to wrap around my head how to summarize this, but I have a concern about how much weight any recommendations we make is going to carry. So I think we're not going to be able to answer that until we get farther down the line in the process. And I think all of our concerns are about being able to weigh in productively and to make sure that our regional goals, which don't align with the state's randomness, are actually met. And things like Harriet mentioned, which is the deed restrictions on affordable housing, because we have a large amount of housing stock that was deed restricted for 30 years under redevelopment that's going to be coming off the books. So if you can get back to us on that, so you'll be writing up an analysis of the pros and cons of the projects that come through. Is that what? Is that how we can?
We'll be submitting some correspondence to the state. I guess at two times. So the first will be the concept proposals, which are, I guess, are a little more limited in how much information they need to contain, and they may not be fully fleshed out. And certainly we want to see fully fleshed out applications. So we're not really at the concept proposal stage. If it looks like somebody's got a good idea and it's going to approach some of the principles that we've got here, I think by all means let's see what they've got in the final applications. Just kind of an initial screen to make sure that we're moving in the right direction. On the final application stage, we will be eventually, and there may be some intermediate steps before this, but back in May, going to our committee and commission with that list and having the commission ultimately approve that list before we send that correspondence out to the state. So that's kind of the timeline for us.
So I would just add, so if this if the Policy Advisory Council wants to see the recommendation and sort of the staff rationale for it, it would come in May.
Yep.
Because it's a pretty tight time frame in terms of when the applications are due and we have to get something to the state. So it would probably need to come kind of like now, the day that it goes to the Programming and Allocations Committee before it goes to the Commission. Because we don't have a lot of time because the applications aren't even due until mid-April. So we couldn't hit your April meeting, but we could come in May and we could explain to you sort of our recommendation to the Commission, and it still wouldn't have been approved by the Commission, and we wouldn't send any correspondence until after the Commission approves it in May. And again, and then it's just advisory to the state. So, you know, but it's still important, and I do think it's important that we make sure that projects are consistent with our regional goals, and especially if we see significant differences. Like, we're very concerned about their GHG methodology, so if our analysis is very different, we would hope to at least be able to give them that information. Obviously, our communities of concern are very different than the state's disadvantaged community definition. So there are certain areas where we do think it's important for us to weigh in, and we can certainly bring it to you with sort of staff's recommendations in May. There is one ministerial step that Matt covered before that, which would be we would just weigh in on whether we think initial applications are supportive of the SCS. But we assume we want as many projects to make it through that hurdle unless they're just completely not even in the ballpark of consistent with the SCS.
Okay, that, yeah, I realize it's not your timeline, so that's kind of the shackles on our hands right now, but I would think that that may be something that the Equity Committee needs to review also. Vita, did you have a comment?
I have a comment, and I would like to see a recommendation come to this committee or the Equity and Access Committee, even though it hasn't been approved by the council. I think that would be a great idea if you forward it to us. My question had to do with the DCC, so the disadvantaged community criteria. Do any of these projects have to meet that criteria since it's so localized and very few parts of the Bay Area?
Fit into that? 50% of the projects in the program must either be located within disadvantaged communities or provide benefits to disadvantaged communities. So that is a statewide threshold, 50%. Not necessarily for, no, that's true, as Alex is whispering in my ear. It's not necessarily for our region. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily need to send forward to SGC a list of projects and meet that threshold necessarily. Obviously, we want projects to be benefiting disadvantaged communities and communities of concern, and that's really why we cast a wider net in our principles in terms of also including communities of concern. But hopefully that answers your question.
So 50% of the projects out of California have to be in that criteria?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Carlos wants a clarification.
Just one is it the 50% of the projects or 50% of the money?
50% of the money from the AHSC program.
So just one more clarification on that. To pick up on Sandy's original question was affordable housing, not putting it all in existing communities of concern, that we could benefit communities of concern by creating a wider scope of affordable housing. Okay. All right, so this will be coming back to us to review. Unless anybody has any other comments, I think we'll wrap this up. Sandy?
Well, given that this is going to the
Programming and Allocations Committee and then the full commission in May. Well, it's going to let me clarify. The principals are going to the commission for approval this month. So that they were approved this morning by one of our committees, but full commission this month. Then in May we're coming back with the project list.
So this concept that was floated around the committee around looking at the deed restrictions that would be part of the affordable housing projects, it would be too late to put something like that into the guidelines at this point?
Well, into the SGC guidelines are final. The state guidelines are...
Right, but I mean as far as our criteria for the Bay Area...
The council can recommend to the commission if you would like us to make an adjustment to the principles. They did ask today that we look in a little bit more detail at the issue of anti-displacement and kind of just affordability generally. So there is a little bit of work to do between the committee and the commission. So if the council would like to recommend something, I would just ask and in your recommendation that you provide direction that you also think that staff can analyze as part of the applications. So, because otherwise it will be hard, you know, if there is something that gets added to the principles and we can't necessarily verify it in the application process. So that's just something to think about. And also, you know, we can think more about that, but that's obviously important.
So what we have right now is attachment C, which is going for approval that we can comment on and add any concerns that we have as if we want somebody wants to make a motion to approve that. And I believe that one of the other concerns was bringing in the coordinated plan to that. So if somebody wants to make a motion, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion that one, we bring it the mention of other adopted transit priorities including the coordinated plan get added to the list. And that staff looks further at other ways to avoid displacement and gentrification, including having deed-restricted covenants put into the affordable housing projects.
Second. Mark had a comment before? Nope. Okay.
Yes, I did.
Okay, well, now we're taking comments on the motion?
No.
Any?
I do. I would just say the one area totally in support of the motion, but within the communities of concern definition, one of the multi-factor analysis is rent burden, cost burden renter households. So I think that would be a pretty ideal thing, a kind of a quick reference to looking at that layer of that analysis. If it's getting updated under vital signs, perhaps, because then it's already something that's, in essence, adopted. It's just adopted as part of another package. So maybe that gets highlighted as the possible threshold for displacement.
Any more comments on the motion? All right. All those in favor of recommending the motion as it was stated, say aye.
Aye.
Yeah, Naomi was the second on the motion. Sandy, do you want to try and recapture the motion again?
Yes, to expand the list of adopted transit priorities in number 4 and to have staff look at further recommendations for avoiding displacement and gentrification, including the possibility of having deed-restricted covenants in the affordable housing projects. I'm trying to state it in a way that if it can't be verified by staff, I'm trying.
Yeah, some of these
these things may also be included in the guidelines. We'll have a look at the language that the state used as well, and that will probably help us think about that.
Okay. Let's try that again. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstaining. Motion carries. Thank you. And I have a feeling we're going to be revisiting this topic over and over and over and over. So the topic with 17 acronyms per sentence. Item number 6 is our DBE Small Business and Title VI update. Yeah. Thank you, Denise.
Good afternoon, Denise Rodriguez. I'm here to give the council an update on DBE, SBE, and Title VI activities undertaken by MTC. So if you thought the last presentation was acronym-laden, hold on to your seats. just a general overview. Attachment A to your packet gives a summary of the DBE, Disadvantaged Business Enterprise, and SBE, Small Business Enterprise, outreach activities that MTC has undertaken either on its own or through the Business Outreach Committee or the BOC. And the BOC is made up of transportation agencies. I told you, hold on, lots of acronyms. Is made up of transportation agencies within the region, and we pull our resources to issue a quarterly newsletter that will help SBEs and DBEs get information on all of the transportation agencies as well as MTC as the MPO for the region of our upcoming contracting opportunities in one place. And also when they attend our outreach events or technical assistance events, then they can get information on all of those, all of our agencies at one time. So there's a synopsis of everything that we've done so far. MTC is also a member of the Caltrans CalMentor program, and the CalMentor program is focused on architectural and engineering firms, and those events are also held quarterly. So it's more professional services on the A&E side, but we bring things to their attention in advance, especially related to the Regional Express Lane program that we'll be implementing soon to try to improve competition and try to open up as much as we can the playing field or level the playing field for those SBE and DBE firms. Some outreach events that we'll have coming up. The next event, we had tentatively scheduled it for March 25th. It will actually be, we have confirmed the date, it will be March 18th. It will be held here in the auditorium. And it's a Meet the Buyer general event on just procuring things that we would get when we order a bag of hats, when we order, you know, food, things like that. Smaller one-off purchases, and all of the Business Outreach Committee or BOC members will be here on that date. The flyer, we're still finalizing that, but as soon as that's ready, I'll send that to Pam, and she can send it out to the council members. We're also working on what we can do to make it easier for the businesses that we're trying to assist. So the next thing we're working on is trying to develop a webinar that we could make available to folks so they don't have to come here. So one of the things that we get questions on a lot is, why should I get certified? And DBE goals are low if there's not a number of ready, willing, and able DBEs or SBEs. So getting certified, there's a lot of information that you have to submit and have reviewed, and it's sort of like, why should I do that? So we were thinking that would be a good one to do as a webinar, and then we'd be able to post it on our website, the MTC website, and the other BOC member websites, so that people, if they can't attend the webinar during the time that we schedule it, can then review it on an ongoing basis. So really try to use technology, because these firms are out there trying to pound the pavement, and to take time out of their day to come here, or even in the evening, is can be burdensome. So we're looking at alternative means to provide technical assistance to those firms. One of the other things that we're doing regarding monitoring, we monitor, or we have goals on federally funded contracts. So we have DBE, or Disadvantaged Business Enterprise, goals for federally funded projects. And we right now monitor those via a manual process. And we're currently in process, conference calls this morning, conference calls Friday, data transfers of putting into place a commercial off-the-shelf system that will allow us to monitor in real time DBE utilization and then also verify DBE utilization. Because that technology is so robust and will make it so much easier for us to track things, we're also going to roll that out for all contracts, regardless of fund type or placement of goals, so that we can look at utilization of SBEs and DBEs on all of our contracts, whether it be state-funded, BATA contracts, things like that, and really get a snapshot of how that outreach we're doing is, how's it playing out, and what we can do to react in real time rather than what we're doing now is manual, and it's always a couple months after the fact. I mean, it's just the way it is. So this process, and I can work with Pam, as we get closer to rolling it out, we're piloting now with a couple contractors to see how it's going to work. But in general, what it is our contracts will be placed into what's called B2G, or Business to Government Now, a system, and the contract will be placed there, and the contractor will report on their payments that they've received and who they've paid out to, what subcontractors. From that, the system will then send an automatic email to the subcontractors they've said that they've paid to verify that those subcontractors really got paid. So not only will it show us the utilization, but it's also going to do the verification of that. So, and then we'll be able to have a dashboard and look at what we're doing in a real-time basis. And so we will be we're rolling that out in July, and we'll be in all of our committee memos moving forward in July, whether it's the admin committee or BATA ops or programming allocations. If you're moving forward with a contract recommendation, there'll be information on the status of the prime contractor and any subcontractors, whether or not they're DBEs or SBEs, and then when those contracts are brought forward, if they are brought forward for requests for additional funds, then utilization of SBEs and DBE firms will also be included in those committee memos, because this technology will allow us to have that at our fingertips. So I just wanted to make the council aware of that as well. Last July, staff brought forward the draft 2014 MTC Title VI program, and then it was moved forward to our commission and submitted to the Federal Transit Administration, as is required every 3 years now, submitted to them in August of last year. At this point, it's still under review. The report itself was only about 80 pages, but with all the appendices, it was probably at least 3 reams of paper. So, there is a lot to review there. So we'll report back, staff will report back once we get either some information on corrective action or any additional information they want. We'll continue to report back to this council on that. One of the other things we did was make some minor updates to the staff Title VI training based on the FTA circular that was updated, I want to say, in late 2013. And we rolled that out to all staff, and that will now be when new staff come on as part of their onboarding, they'll be required to take that Title VI training, and it's an online training that we can verify that's been done. There's some questions at the end that have to be answered correctly for them to pass. The JARC and New Freedom programs are programs that we have a program management plan for that we get FTA funding directly on, and MTC actively monitors those contracts because they mainly go to nonprofits or smaller firms. One of the things we're continuing to do is monitor those. The FTA certs and assurances were issued and will be submitting to the JARC and New Freedom subrecipients a request to complete those certs and assurances, along with sending us their updated Title VI plans and LEP plans by May of this year. So I just wanted to point that out. And then one of the last things I'll mention is the CLIPR program. We have ongoing Title VI activities for outreach to minority and low-income groups, as well as those with limited English proficiencies or LEPs. And Attachment B has a list of all of the CLIPR activities and also includes information on those targeted outreach for minority and LEP populations. So With that, I'll conclude my presentation and ask you if you have any questions.
Questions? Comments? Kathleen?
So I think the kind of new B2G portal that you're doing sounds great for kind of the immediate and applying it to all contracting. So is there going to be something from the vendor side, kind of a web portal or something, that makes it easier for them to provide like their Title VI work and some of their reporting into MTC?
Not for Title VI right now. This would just be subcontractor usage. But we've been talking with B2G, and it's a real niche program. And since more and more agencies are doing Title VI work, that could be something that they could probably look to add. There is a user group that's coming in June for B2G, and our IT staff will probably be attending that, and I can make sure to mention that to them. Because that you're bringing that up, and it's my Title VI hat. You know, you get so deep in the weeds sometimes in the other stuff, you forget. Well, that would be good to have, too. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it just seems like sometimes the reporting is a deterrent to some of the smallest organizations.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Vita.
Your outreach plan for Clipper was great, and I wonder if there are any plans to continue that in 2015.
Oh, yes, and I won't take credit for Clipper staff. The electronics payments. What's the S stand for? EPS.
Payment systems.
Thank you. Electronic payment systems. We have so many acronyms, and I don't even know what they are. That's embarrassing. So the EPS group does continued outreach related to Clipper. You know, just making sure that we, you know, keep the market share we have. We always want to gain market share, and then as new operators come on board, to make sure that they, in those areas, people have information, and all groups have the information and access to Clipper. So they are definitely going to continue that, and all continue to report on their activities to this council.
Carlos?
Yes. Thanks, Denise. I wanted to, I think it's a great concept to bring the these events to a webinar situation like that. I think and then particularly then posting it on the website. I think you're right in terms of the business businesses. It's hard for them to come here and then also just take the time off. So I think that's a great concept. And you've probably told us this before, but forgive me. But I wanted to the outreach for these events. Is it through like the ethnic chambers and what other venues do you normally go to get the outreach for these events?
So we do multiple things. We as soon as the flyers are put out, we post them on the MTC website, and then we use that link. We send so we don't look like we're sending spam. We send it to DBEs and firms registered on our databases. We also send it to plan rooms, to local chambers, and things like that. We have a whole roster of those that we send it to. So, and then we ask whenever we have events, if you want to receive the newsletter, you want to receive information on these upcoming events, to sign up. So you could, if you're a DBE who's registered with MTC, and then you're a member of a chamber, you could get it three times, but you won't, because the system that we use to send the email gets rid of redundant emails. So you would get one notice, which would then send you a link that you could click through, take you to the MTC website to see the flyer, and then if there is a registration required, then you would register. We try not to require registration. We always try to have venues that are big enough, because that's just one more thing to do, right? And it's like, am I going to make it or not? And we don't want to have any deterrence. So it's usually just, if you can make it, please do. Yeah.
Any more questions or comments? Thank you.
All right.
Oh, wait, Jim?
Okay. Okay, I'm on. Just to follow up now, in your database, are you primarily sending out with email blasts as well? How does that work?
We send email. That's how we correspond with all of the vendors that we're trying to outreach to. We stopped sending U.S. mail about 2 years ago.
Oh, I see. That's great. And how often do you send out the email contacts?
The email goes out when there's a new newsletter. that's or there's an event that we're and so the newsletter is posted quarterly, and we try to have quarterly events as part of the business outreach committee. In addition, we're trying to do some targeted or focused outreach just for MTC. And when I say MTC, I'm referring to BATA, et cetera, for some contracts that we have coming up. So we're having an information session next week on a resource and total compensation study that we're planning to do. So that's a procurement. So we would send an email that way saying, here's an information session. It's not an RFP yet because we're trying to give information to firms, all types, large firms, but we're really doing this to focus on SBEs and DBEs. So they get advance notice of what's coming with the project managers in the room focused on just that procurement before the procurement's let, and then we give time at the end, so there's Q&A, in-depth information, and then time for those groups to network just for that specific procurement. So to answer your question, it's as technical assistance or outreach events are issued, we send the email, or when the newsletter is posted, we send an email. I mean, we don't want to inundate people, but I'd rather people know about things, and it's just an email, and if they want to hit delete, they can hit delete. They could also have the option of opting out. If they feel that there's too many emails, they can do that. Yeah. But I think we run a nice, it's about, you know, so once or twice a quarter based on events.
Thank you. Vita?
I want to thank you for the packet that you put together for us. Your flyers are very well laid out. They're divided by county or program. I mean, everything looks terrific here. And I really like the idea of webinars myself. I'm a big fan of webinars, keeping people, you know, off the highways.
Yeah. Yeah, we try to promote public transit. And it's really by pulling our resources with the Business Outreach Committee that we're able to, you know, sometimes you have a great idea, but if you don't have the resource to do a webinar, that's one thing. So the fact that there's, you know, 15 of us agencies, you know, throwing at ideas and, yeah, it'd be great to do a webinar. Oh, MTC has the ability to host the webinar. You know, it's a collaborative effort. So thank you, and I'll make sure to pass it on to the group at our meeting on Friday. Thanks.
Thank you. Last call for questions and comments. Thank you, Denise.
Thanks.
Next up is our legislative update, Teresa.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am not your regular legislative update person, as you can tell. I am... Yeah. Rebecca Long is usually the one who gives us update, and she couldn't be here today. She's in Sacramento. So please bear with me, and I'll try to answer your questions as best I can. Today I'm going to be presenting on recent activities related to both the state and the federal budget processes. And I'll start with the state. The governor's state budget proposal for fiscal year 15-16 was released in January. And on a positive note, Governor Brown, in his State of the State address, as well as in the main budget summary, it was very transportation-focused, and he noted the need for investment in our deteriorating state highway infrastructure, bridges, et cetera. Although no specific funding mechanisms were mentioned, there are several options that will be up for consideration, I imagine, in the near future. On a negative note, however, a significant item in the proposed budget is the decline in fuel tax-based revenues for transportation purposes. Over the last 9 months, we've seen a decline of about 40% in the price of gasoline, which the Department of Finance is forecasting that the Board of Equalization will probably reduce the variable portion of the gasoline excise tax by 5.5 cents this year. And just as a little bit of background, the excise tax currently is about 36 cents. 18 cents of that is the base excise tax. And the other variable portion, the other 18 cents, dates back to the gas tax swap of 2010, during which the state's share of the sales tax on gasoline was replaced with a variable excise tax. And each year, the Board of Equalization is required to adjust the excise tax in order for it to equal what the state what the sales tax on gasoline would have generated, thereby preserving this revenue neutrality. So the upcoming reduction to the excise tax will result in a revenue decrease of about $770 million statewide. The reduction will have a significant impact on local streets and roads, the State Transportation Improvement Program, that's the STIP, and the State Highway Operation and Protection Program, or the SHOP. For the Bay Area alone, we expect a reduction in fuel tax revenue between local roads and the STIP of about $150 million in 2015-16. And I don't think we covered this item quite enough. So the budget also included an estimate of $1 billion for the amount of revenue to be generated by the state's cap and trade program in fiscal year 2015-16. We don't have really a solid forecast, however, of how much that will be generated in the quarterly auctions, given that the first auction with transportation fuels under the cap will actually occur later this month. As Matt mentioned earlier, the May revise of the budget will likely have a more accurate estimate of cap and trade revenue. But the transportation programs that will receive shares of cap and trade revenues based on SB 862 legislation, assuming the $1 billion level, is high-speed rail will receive 25%, or $250 million. Affordable housing and sustainable communities, 20%, or $200 million. Transit and intercity rail, 10%, or $100 million. And the low-carbon transit operations program, 5%, or $50 million. And that's assuming the 1%, because they could go up or down based on what the total revenue generations are. The budget also proposes funding levels for non-transportation purposes, approximately 40% of the total cap and trade revenue. I won't go into those. Those are mentioned in your memo. Somewhat related to the discussion of the gas tax revenue decline is the budget's estimate for state transit assistance, which is funded through a portion of the state sales tax on diesel fuel. The budget forecasts a funding level of $388 million, which is higher than what the state controller initially estimated by about $13 million. This increase that's in the budget seems to be overly optimistic to us, given that diesel prices have fallen over the last 9 months about 30%. So not quite the same decline as regular gasoline, but still a pretty significant amount. The Bay Area receives a little over a third of the total state transit assistance funding statewide. So MTC is warning transit operators to be cautious in the budgeting of STA revenue for the fiscal year 15-16 year. The budget also contains $1.1 billion in Proposition 1A funds for high-speed rail. The funding would be spent only on the local and regional components of the system, or what we refer to as a blended system, although the specifics on which parts of the local system would be funded were not included in the budget proposal. There were several changes to the Caltrain's budget proposed, including $9.4 million and 5 new staff positions to support and help expedite the road usage charge pilot program. That must be implemented by January of 2017 and is tasked with studying the potential for a road usage charge as an alternative to the gas tax. $7 million and 64 new positions to maintain and improve transportation management system elements, such as ramp meters and communication links with traffic management centers. 25 new positions to work on project initiation documents for $300 million in new SHOP projects, and build a shelf of $500 million in roadway and bridge projects so that we are shovel-ready, so to speak, in case new funding opportunities come along. And lastly, the budget incorporates some policy statements that the administration likely intends to pursue, such as the restoration of the California Transportation Commission's ability to approve new express lanes, and streamline the process for the state to relinquish state highways to local governments administratively rather than legislatively. So the next steps on the state budget process include budget hearings beginning in March, and MTC staff and our lobbyists will be working to try and avert the gas tax cuts that are going to go into effect in July 1st. while also working with transportation partners in developing a funding package to increase state funding for transportation in general. I guess I can move on to the federal budget unless, and then we can do questions after if there's any questions. Okay. Okay, so moving on the federal side, the president released his fiscal year 2016 budget in February, which included a total of $95 billion in both discretionary and mandatory funding for transportation, specifically $51 billion for the Federal Highway Administration, which is a 25% increase over the current year, and $18.4 billion for Federal Transit Administration funding. This includes about almost $14 billion for formula programs, and that's a pretty significant increase of about 62% over our current year funding. $3.3 billion for capital investment grants, and a $500 million for a new rapid growth area for bus rapid transit corridor program. It's a mouthful, too. The increases proposed in the budget are dependent on the successful enactment of the administration's multi-year reauthorization proposal, which is far from certain. And speaking of that, the president used the release of the budget as an opportunity to lay out a six-year surface transportation authorization plan. And as proposed, the expanded program would be paid for with a one-time 14% tax on U.S. companies' overseas profits as part of a broader tax reform plan. Specifically, the authorization plan proposal includes the creation of an $18 billion freight program, $23 billion in 2016 for transit and passenger rail programs, $144 billion over the full 6 years for that, the establishment of an infrastructure permitting center to develop and implement reforms for the permitting and review of major infrastructure projects, and the creation of a current passenger rail service program for state of repair needs on the nation's rail system and a rail service improvement program. So staff will continue reviewing the budget and authorization proposal and will provide additional detail at your next meeting. Okay, that's my summary.
Thank you. Jerry?
Going back to the state budget, on page 3, right at the bottom, the last item, streamlining the process for the state to relinquish state highways to local government. Could you talk a little bit about the rationale for that? It seems every time a higher level of government relinquishes their responsibilities to lower levels, the burden both administratively and cost-wise ends up with the local entity, and this seems to be an onerous opportunity, for onerous burden on the localities.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
I believe that's a good answer to your question. Yes.
I believe both parties have to be willing, and I haven't. I don't know if you have a lot of experience with this, but I think the examples that I'm aware of, you know, there is a negotiated cost into that transfer, cost and payment.
Right. Generally, what happens with those is that even when there's a negotiated settlement, if you will, that tends to disappear in bad times or over the course of years just by attrition. So it is a real concern of mine, I know, having dealt with community development for decades and the problems that localities have had to face with that issue.
I think it is a significant, you know, policy issue. I mean, I think in a lot of respects, when you look at the SCS, there could be some real opportunities that could come from relinquishment, but without sort of a transfer of revenue to kind of support proper relinquishment and maintaining the facility over time, I think the concerns you raised are definitely, you know, they're right. So, you know, it's an interesting policy issue, though, because, like I said, I mean, I think there's a lot of state facilities that potentially aren't able to you know, be what the community wants them to be in terms of complete streets or this or that, right, because really they're not owned in the community, but just sort of transferring them to this, from the state to the local, without having the resources for the locals to maintain something that really there is some money at the state level that's currently maintaining that, but that if that stays at the state and then now the facility is the locals' responsibility, then that's the, you know, the concerns that you've raised are very valid.
So I'm going to be devil's advocate here because San Jose has a project that was an example of how it works out to everybody's benefit. And MTC was involved. They helped finance it. And the key was actually, because it is generally generated by the local community, the state doesn't pay any attention to their inventory until somebody says, we don't like this. And it turned out to be a great project that revitalized an entire area that provided safe haven for people to get across a street. And it was Alameda, the Beautiful Way Project. And it was one of those where it can be done, but the key is really the negotiating. Once Caltrans is done with it, making sure that the existing infrastructure was upgraded before the local community took over the process of maintaining it. And we were extremely lucky that we had these partnerships in our area to make this happen and to take what was a highway running through a neighborhood and turn it into a, still carries capacity, will be a BRT site, and still provides a walkable, livable neighborhood and business district. So there is hope. There is hope. So just want to make sure that everybody knows there's hope for this.
Thank you for your report. It's dancing, rich with questions. So I'll just start with this one here at the budget in this same area that we were just talking about. And the restoration of California Transportation Commission, so the ability to approve new express lanes. Can you tell us a little bit about that and if we have any areas that we'd like to, that we're thinking about creating express lanes?
Well, Rebecca would definitely be better to answer this question, and she's in Sacramento. But the CTC did have authority, and I don't remember the bill number, to approve express lanes, and it expired in 2010, let's say, or 2012, sometime recently. So this would just sort of give them the authority again. I think MTC obviously is supportive of express lanes as sort of another tool for mobility in the region. I think there's other places in the state that want to look at express lanes as sort of a similar tool and an opportunity. But right now, because this bill did sunset, it was sort of a pilot, and MTC did go to the CTC and get some approval for the sort of initial express lanes that we are working on in the Bay Area. But we think there could be future opportunities, and like I said, elsewhere in the state, there are regions and cities that are looking at express lanes. So I think generally, you know, we would probably support the CTC having the ability to kind of look at these applications again, because again, the prior bill had a sunset date.
I'm going to follow up with one other question on the federal side. It looks as if that increasing funding for transit and passenger rail program to $23 billion in 2016 and $144 billion over 6 years. You must have been very excited to hear about that. And I'm wondering if there are any programs that we already have in place that could participate in that program.
I think excitement tempered with a dose of reality in terms of it actually being passed would probably be more accurate. But I don't know. I'll leave that up to you if there's any.
Yeah, definitely a dose of reality. We haven't yet seen a credible strategy for how to pay for these increases. We think that they're starting to be serious discussion about paying for a comprehensive federal bill. But, you know, there's... Until there's really, you know, agreement across the aisle on how they're going to fund infrastructure. And in the past, we haven't seen that in a long time. So we're very, very cautious in optimism, I guess.
On page 2 of the state report, that state the STA paragraph, it looks a little like the shell game. CAS funding, the forecasts of $388 million, which is $2 million above the estimated revenues, 14 and 15, which are now $13 million higher than state controllers. So then the 3% modest increase. So transit entities looking at STA money, this seems to be a moving target based on, again, the gas tax. I mean, this doesn't...
I think earlier in the year, the state controller estimated that in 15-16 we would have about $375 million in revenue available for that year, and we anticipated with the budget release that that number would be revised downward, but instead it was actually revised upward. So all we're saying is that we don't understand the
oh, good. That's exactly.
Yeah, we don't really understand how they're developing their numbers, on what basis, given the decrease in fuel prices.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Jim?
Yes. Now, you said... in the national or the federal budget, there's money for capital investment grants. Can you tell me a little bit more about those grants, and does any of the money flow down to the state level?
The capital investment grant program at the federal level includes money for new starts and for small starts, and I think for a new program they're calling core capacity. And so the Bay Area does have several projects that are receiving new starts and small starts funding. The BART extension to Berryessa is receiving new starts funds. The Central Subway project is receiving new starts funds. AC Transit has been receiving small starts funds. So, again, this is all just a proposal right now. It's not an approved budget, but
right.
Those projects do have sort of what's called a full funding grant agreement, so they are expected to continue to receive money out of that, out of the capital investment program.
So it comes down even to the local level, then, if it's approved.
Yes.
Thank you. Any more questions, Kathleen?
Within the gas tax cut that seems to be coming, is that $150 million loss to us, would that be enough for some of the local jurisdictions to, like, rejigger some prioritization of their projects for their local streets and roads monies?
It represents about a 23% decrease. So I don't understand what you mean by...
Well, like, I know some cities or jurisdictions are really good, in my opinion, mm-hmm. about devoting a certain amount of LSNR monies to complete streets improvements, to other improvements that are just more broadly supportive than just, like, maintaining pavement.
Mm-hmm.
Or they try to incorporate some of those improvements in the maintenance they're already doing. Would jurisdictions start to cut back on some of those things that they see as more enhancements?
I imagine if they had budgeted for a certain amount and they, you know, are getting 23% less, then, yeah, that would definitely translate into a reduction. I don't know that, from what projects, but it definitely is a significant impact that they would have to make adjustments to meet.
Thank you. Last call for questions or comments. Thank you, Teresa. Item 8, staff liaison report.
Okay. Well, I will go through the memo as quickly as I can. I do have a few new items. Sometimes things float to the top in between the time that I publish the report and the time that I get here to the meeting. So next month, Dave Vaughton will be here to walk you through the Vital Signs website. If you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, I encourage you to take a look through, but he'll be here to answer any questions that you might have and walk you through. So I did get that out there for you. Also, we publish a congestion report that gives a top 10 list of the worst places in the Bay Area for congestion. That's up on our website. So if you're interested, you can go and figure out where's the worst place to drive. There's a few express lanes open houses that have been going on. The last one's coming up Wednesday, February 25th. And I wanted to make sure you had a chance to go to that. If you can't make it physically to that, there is an online open house that's occurring, open through March the 6th. So it's www.BayAreaExpressLanes.org. So you can do the online open house. And last month, I gave you an update on our commission structure. We got a few new commissioners, and we have one more in the form of Oakland Mayor Libby Schaff. So we welcome her, and I think she's already attended her first meeting. Yeah. So the other thing that we're doing, we've gone green in many ways, and our annual report has been green for, I think, the last two versions. And so that is out now. There's a lot of photos. It's very much a pictorial, so you can view that online as well. And then the other thing, the Golden Gate Bridge got its median barrier. Those of you who have been following that story, it's finally there, and it was inaugurated in a ceremony about a month ago. So you can actually view the ceremony if you want online. The new things that I have to report, we closed recruitment for this council, the three vacancies on this council on Monday. So we'll be going through those applications that we received. I do want to report that we will continue to leave recruitment open in Contra Costa County for a disabled rep. We did not receive applicants that are actually fit the bill in that county. So if you know of anyone, that application is still open online in Contra Costa County for someone who represents the disabled community. So spread the word. Also, this group has been instrumental in the past, just being interested in the community-based outreach we've done for Plan Bay Area. And we just started an RFP, request for proposals that went out yesterday, and I just wanted you to know that it's up now on the web for community-based outreach for Plan Bay Area. 2015 through 2017 will be the work that those community groups will be doing with me as the project manager. So you can talk to me more about it if you're interested in it. Some of you know of the past work we've done with community-based groups. They've been primarily in communities of concern. You can view that RFP on the web. And we did do, as Denise talked about, doing a two-week push out to our database, to people that are in our database, so they got advance notice of that RFP, so they knew that it was coming out. So they've had 2 weeks to know that it was coming, so that was good. But let me know if you're interested in more information, and more information is also on our webs in the jobs and contracts, on our website in the jobs and contracts section. And also in the jobs and contracts section is our high school internship program, and that's the last thing I want to mention to you that you've also been interested in, and that is open as well. And the deadline to apply is March 8th. It's a Sunday. I guess high school kids will be home and able to apply on a Sunday, and their parents will be standing over them saying, get your application in. The program goes through the summer, and we have about 40 spots open this year. So there's a good chance out there. So if you know of any high school kids that are interested in transportation jobs, it's all throughout the nine counties. It could be with BART. It could be with a county position. Any type of job that's related to transportation, we would encourage them to apply. So that's all I have.
You skipped this part.
What did I skip?
This part, new commission chairs.
Oh,
I didn't listen this morning.
Who was elected
chair? Oh, they went too fast? Oh. Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay. I guess I will have to report that at your next meeting.
It's probably a five-minute meeting.
Okay, well, and it is audio cast, so you're welcome to listen in if you don't want to wait till the next meeting. My apologies.
Thank you, Pam. We're up to council member reports. Anybody have anything to report on locally relevant issues? Going once, twice, three times. New business for future meetings? Ha. Okay. Then at this point, with nothing left to discuss, I think we're adjourned. And then we're 15 minutes, right?
Yay.
Yay.